This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
North Korean troops are fighting Ukrainians in Russia and quite possibly being killed by US missiles, finally permitted by Washington to be used deep into Russian territory. Meanwhile, Iranian rockets land on targets in Ukraine. It's over 1,000 days since Vladimir Putin's full-scale invasion of his neighbour, and the circle of those involved in the conflict seems to widen. But though the situation changes, the central question doesn't. That question being which side can best stay the bloody course of this war? Ukraine and the West, or Russia and its allies? Where do things stand now? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, Michael Clark, visiting professor in the Department of War Studies, King's College London, and former director of the Royal United Services Institute, gives us a quick rundown on the recent story of the Ukraine conflict.
When the Russians first walked in on the 24th of February 2022, what they intended quite clearly was a military-backed coup, because they intended to seize the government in Kyiv within 72 hours and then suppress any problems they had in the major eastern cities within 3 or 4 weeks after that. That had to be the intention because they didn't devote enough troops to do anything more. They had fewer than 190,000 troops in a territory that's the biggest territory in Europe, apart from Russia itself, and a country of 44 million people. So it's far too small a force to invade the country. When we talk about a coup, most people think of it as an internal struggle. And there was some sense of that in what the Russians were trying. They had a puppet government ready to move in and take over. And they had at least two or three squads in Kyiv, all of whom were tasked to get hold of Zelensky and his family and kill them. And we all remember there was lots of wild firing in the streets of Kyiv.
You can hear the artillery. That is outgoing fire from Ukrainian forces. The fear here is that very soon Russian forces will be making their way down here.
At least two and probably three of those assassination squads were gunned down. No survivors. They were just summarily gunned down by the Ukrainians. And what really happened was that Zelensky came out on the streets less than 48 hours after the beginning of the invasion, and the most important speech of his life.
Голова офісу президента тут, прем'єр-міністр Шмигаль тут, Подоляк тут, президент тут.
He made out on the street, lasted no more than 40 seconds, and he said, I'm here, the Minister of Defense is here, the Foreign Minister is here, here we are in Kyiv, we're not going anywhere, we are here. And that established the fact that he was alive, he would continue to resist, and the Ukrainians would fight.
Слава нашим захисникам, слава нашим захисницям, слава Україні. Слава Україні.
And then the Russian strategy seemed to change to being a strategy of conquest of the Donbas region and as much as they could get of the country east of the Dnieper River.
Russian and Ukrainian forces have clashed along a broad front across the eastern Donbass region on the first full day of a new phase of Moscow's invasion.
So then it turned into a struggle for conquest in the autumn of 2022, but the Russians were doing very badly. And those first two strategies played to Ukrainian strengths and Western strengths in helping Ukraine to outwit the Russians. And the Russians were very incompetent in the way they conducted their operations. Then it changed in really 2023. In the spring of 2023, Putin doubled down and doubled down on the doubling down.
This is a continued attempt by the Kremlin to try to legitimize its occupation, but also to send a message to Kyiv that it's digging in for the long haul. We have yet.
Since the spring and summer of 2023, it has been increasingly a war of attrition in which a country like Ukraine, which is actually only got about 33 million people who now live outside the Russian-dominated areas, are up against a country of about 140 million people in Russia with an economy that's a great deal bigger. A war of attrition is a war in which neither side expects to make dramatic breakthroughs, but to grind the other side down. And however brave the Ukrainians are and however inventive they are, without more Western support, they were always going to struggle in a war of attrition. And it pointed up the weaknesses of Western support because the West doesn't seem to be prepared really for a war of attrition.
Ukraine is desperately in need of continued assistance from the United States and obviously the European community as well, and that it's very important for us to get this.
The Russians have lost a great many men. The casualties are said now to have reached about 700,000. That's killed and seriously wounded. They will certainly go to over a million if they carry on in this way into the spring of next year. And they've bent their economy out of shape in order to conduct this war. Ukraine has found itself having to deal with the problem that it cannot win, it can only lose slowly. And that's what it's doing. One silver lining for the Ukrainians is that in this war of attrition, the Russian economy will start to suffer, by most estimates, quite severely next year. If the Ukrainians could somehow keep going for maybe another 12 months, the Russian economy may be in serious trouble, and it will affect, in some respects, the way they are able to fight this war.
Michael Clark, who'll be back with us later. Now, as Michael mentioned, one critical aspect of whether the war can be sustained is the state of Russia's economy, where things seem to be changing. To explain how is Alina Rybakova, Senior Fellow at Peterson Institute of International Economics in Washington, D.C. Alina Rybakova, in past programmes looking at the Russian economy, we've heard that although things have got gradually worse since the beginning of the war, the regime has found various ways through it. But now, right now, there's kind of a sense that those difficulties are accumulating. So could you take us through what the strains currently are on the Russian economy?
It appeared in the beginning that Russian economy has stabilized over the last 2 years. We saw some growth in the Russian economy, and many people said that, look, sanctions aren't working. However, what is hiding beneath the surface is an overheating economy. We have seen a strong expansion in credit. We have seen the central bank increase rates beyond 21%. And we've seen a strong pickup in inflation. And all of that is manifesting itself in weaker ruble by the minute.
How much does the weakening of the currency, the ruble, actually matter? And why does it matter?
The weakening of the currency matters because it spills over into the domestic economy and domestic prices. We have seen people complaining already about the price of eggs going up significantly, right? So the core goods that Russian people are buying have increased meaningfully. The central bank is recording inflation at just over 8%, but I think it understates the degree of the problem. So the spillover of ruble into domestic prices and therefore discontent of the local population, that's what really matters.
How much of this is down to sanctions and how much of this is simply down to the fact of having to try and produce so much for the war effort?
It's the most important question, and it's very hard to break it down into sort of very clear coefficients. I do think that sanctions matter. Recently, we have seen announcement, I think, more than 50 banks, so including Gazprom Bank. And I think that is definitely contributing to the weakening of the ruble in the recent days. At the same time, we have seen Russian economy producing more and more of the war-related sectors. The only sectors that have been growing over the last 2 years are war-related. So the long story short, it's very hard to disentangle, but we do know that both are having an effect.
Now, can you remind us what Russia has done so far to try and overcome these economic shortcomings, how it's got round sanctions?
In terms of the circumvention of sanctions, countries like China, India, UAE, Turkey have helped Russia meaningfully to divert trade. So China is now the largest trading partner for Russia. India is a very significant buyer of oil. And it doesn't mean that China is producing something that Russia necessarily needs for the war machine. What China and other countries are doing, they're on-shipping Western components for Russian military.
Can we just talk a bit about Russian businesses? You talked about the price of eggs as being, if you like, a kind of major indicator of what Russian people are encountering. What's happening to Russian businesses who aren't in the war sector?
Let's look at the crown jewels. Let's look at Rosneft. Let's look at Gazprom. Rosneft is the dominant energy producer, the oil producer for Russia. Gazprom used to be the crown jewel of the state and controlled enterprises. This is the company that exports gas globally and also supplies domestically. So Gazprom used to realize 2/3 of their profits on the 1/3 of the production that went to mostly Europe. Of course, because of logistical constraints, once the Europe was cut off, they couldn't redirect this trade. So they recorded the highest loss in recent history. Rosneft is also having a difficult time. And we're not even talking about the state-controlled banks, which are now being forced to lend at subsidized rates to domestic military industry.
Does that lead to a lack of money available for investment in other Russian industries?
Absolutely. There is a crowding out effect where the domestic military industrial complex is sucking up the money that otherwise would be available for more productive and sort of long-term potential growth enhancing production in Russia.
Now, how would a Russian consumer begin to experience the consequences of that kind of thing happening?
Well, the Russian consumer has already started experiencing it almost 10 years ago. After 2014 sanctions, a Russian budget was consolidated. A lot of social spending, education, healthcare was cut down to be able to cut the budget, to build the fortress, and to potentially prepare for this war. So if you remember, Russia didn't really close much during COVID because it couldn't afford to do so already then. And since 2022, Russian consumer had to switch to lower quality goods. You know, Chinese cars are not always the same as German-made cars or any other. They had to switch to lower quality goods. They may be the same price, and that maybe understates inflation, but it's definitely not the same quality. So they're feeling that already. At the same time, some of the regions left behind by the economic growth in recent years, they're seeing improvements because the payments from recruitment or maybe military production are beginning to trickle down into those regions.
Does that mean, for example, that some of the outlying regions are getting slightly wealthier, but some of the big cities are having bigger problems than they did?
Absolutely. You've seen much more of the sort of concentration of the middle class, more productive, more sort of people who could travel, highly skilled in the larger industrial zones or cities like Moscow, St. Petersburg, Kaluga. And these people, some of them have left. We've estimated migration at more than at close to 1 million people. And these are people, the most skilled, sort of the most productive middle class of Russian society. At the same time, we have seen increase in wages for males unqualified of a certain military age of almost 30%. So basically, there is increase in wages for physical bodies, not even increase in productivity, right? And that's where, unfortunately, we see where either these people are signing up for contract, maybe they're not coming back and the families are getting the money, or these people are going to produce Kalashnikovs. And therefore, in the poorer regions, you see some pickup in wages and in growth.
Right. And I suppose the big question at the end of all this is, how long can Russia's economy sustain its war ambitions? I mean, can it carry on at the current rate forever?
No, Russia can't carry on forever, right? We always have discussions about pricking bubbles, right? It is clearly a bubble. We're more used to financial sector bubbles or property bubbles, right? But unfortunately, this is a military bubble. That makes it very difficult to stop purposefully because it will be a big collapse and disintegration of the economy. So, of course, they want to see the musical chairs sort of game keep on going. They cannot do it indefinitely because they won't have enough resources. Unfortunately, they still have a reasonable position on the fiscal. They have some money left in their reserve fund. So to continue for the next year, as long as they continue to successfully export oil to the global market, the Russian economy can continue for a year.
Elena, how dependent is Russia on the oil price staying high or as high as it is now?
Energy revenues for Russia are the lifeline for the whole economy. Russia is critically dependent on energy revenue. If oil price were to go from what it is now around 70s to 40 or 50, Russian economy would be in crisis.
Is that drop likely?
I think coming closer to 60s next year, I think it is likely.
Elena Rybakova. And just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about the danger from synthetic opioids, the one about European defence in the new Trump era, and the one about what the budget means for the UK economy. Now back to the war in Ukraine and how it seems likely to develop. Michael Clark is still here with me, and we're joined by the defence editor of The Economist, Shashank Joshi. Shashank Joshi, a lot has happened in the last few weeks. There was the Biden policy that allows the Ukrainians to use their long-range missiles into Russia, and the Russians have brought in North Korean troops. They did that a bit before. Can you tell us, Shashank, what you think are the biggest developments in recent weeks that you've noted?
I'd say they're the ones you've identified, but also I think the sense that this could become a bigger pipeline of forces, not just a few thousand troops, but I've heard Ukrainians say to me, we're worried about having 100,000 North Koreans here by the spring. And I think the other two things I'd point out, David, briefly are Ukraine's battlefield situation is still getting worse. Russia's still progressing. And finally, looking ahead, the specter of Donald Trump is looming over Europe, I think, more definitively. And there is really more activity in Europe, across Europe, asking, how are we going to respond to this incoming administration, particularly on Ukraine? What can we do to persuade Mr. Trump to remain committed? What might that require of us as Europeans?
Right, we'll be taking up some of those directly a bit later. Michael, can I just ask you about the North Korean troops? This is the first time I've ever heard this figure of 100,000. Is North Korea officially at war with Ukraine?
Well, technically they don't have to be because they're aiding an ally fighting on Russian soil. And as long as they do that, that's just help to a friendly power. And I'm certain that this 10,000 is a bit of an experiment. If they get on well, if it looks as if it's successful, there will be 100,000. I mean, that figure is being toted around because that's the sort of figure that would make a difference to the whole battlefront. The Russians have got about 400,000 troops in the battlefront. If they had 100,000 North Koreans or even more than that, then they really would start to overwhelm what the Ukrainians can put against them.
Can I ask you what may seem like a sort of really strange question, but if the North Koreans can go into Russia because they're an ally to protect them from the Ukrainians, why shouldn't European troops go into Ukraine to protect them from the Russians in Ukraine?
It's a strange contradiction, isn't it? I mean, suddenly it's completely unacceptable for the Western powers to help Ukraine. It's completely unacceptable for the Western powers, according to Putin, to give missiles for use in Russia. But it's fine for the North Koreans to give ballistic missiles for use against Ukraine. It's fine for the Iranians now to give ballistic missiles. So the Russians are operating a completely double standard here. But in their mind, it's not a double standard because in their mind, Ukraine is actually Russia.
But David, I think the thing your question misses is that it's a legal framing. It's not about the law. This is about political judgments and our risk tolerance. North Korea is willing to join this war because it does not fear the risk that Ukraine, a non-nuclear power, will then attack North Korea. We are afraid, as the West, of entering a direct war with Russia, which is on top of that a nuclear power.
And risk tolerance, Michael, is partially expressed in terms of red lines being crossed, isn't it? And one of the things that interests me is that continuously now, during the course of the last few months, we've seen red lines that previously existed seemingly crossed.
Yes, I mean, we have thresholds and the Russians have red lines, and we keep crossing thresholds. So we weren't going, we had a threshold over multiple launch rocket systems. We weren't going to supply them until we did. We had a threshold over supplying main battle tanks until we did. We had a threshold about supplying ATACMS missiles and Storm Shadow missiles until we did. And now we have a threshold about not being used in Russia. We've crossed that threshold. So now we do. And each time the Russians have red lines. And so we cross thresholds and they establish red lines and then ignore them or don't do anything about them. And the fact is that Putin is doing his worst in Ukraine already. If he could do more, he would. And so what he can do, because he can't really up the ante in Ukraine, he ups the ante rhetorically by making more and more grave and reckless threats. And of course, he always uses the nuclear threat because he knows that that actually has some effect. It certainly has some effect on German politics and on the German public opinion. And it has some effect on Republican opinion in the United States. So the fact is that nuclear rhetoric, even though some of us regard it as ridiculous, it is reckless. And it works.
Shashank Joshi, this February, the war is 3 years old. And when you get to this longitude of a war, you are in a war of attrition, essentially. And what you would expect under those circumstances is the bigger power will inevitably win. Is a Russian victory at the current levels a foregone conclusion?
No, I don't think it is, because wars of attrition are really difficult to judge. For instance, Russia is much, much bigger than Ukraine. However, we are also seeing its economy, as we heard earlier, begin to show some serious signs of overheating and some trouble. And look at Russia's casualties. Its battle deaths as a share of population are way higher than America suffered in Vietnam and Korea combined. This, however, is about staying power. And my concern is that Russia has more staying power at present than Ukraine does, particularly given the politics, given American aid. That, to me, is the big factor. If aid continued for Ukraine, yes, they would suffer a serious problem with mobilization and having enough men. But I think that at some stage, Russia would also begin to experience a serious, serious breakdown in their ability to keep their forces supplied.
Michael, how do you see it?
Yeah, similarly, that in the short term, the Russians will keep on winning slowly. But if the Ukrainians can keep going with enough Western help, if they keep going for the rest of this year and into next year, then we may see a different complexion because, for all sorts of reasons, I think the Russians will struggle. And it's already clear that the Russians can only keep up this tempo with regular supplies of artillery from North Korea, regular supplies of drones and ballistic missiles from Iran, and also effectively weapons from China, components for weapons, not finished weapons, but components that keep Russian weapons and other weapons going. So the Russians are dependent on their own backers, the autocratic states that are backing them, to keep this tempo of operations going.
Okay, I mean, the question you pose is whether it isn't easier to get autocratic states to support you than it is to get democratic states to support you.
Absolutely true. I mean, the fact is, what we've got now is this really quite close coalition, at least in this matter, between Russia, China, North Korea and Iran. And the longer this war has gone on, the more they have become determined to help each other, because they take Putin's point, I think, that this war in Ukraine is the front line in a global struggle to break the influence of the West across world politics. You know, the rest of the world is standing back to see what happens. The global South is seeing what happens. And if they see that the West is humbled by this war, whatever happens in Ukraine, that will be a big step towards global transformation. And, you know, if some sort of deal is imposed next year for a truce, Ukraine will lose maybe 20% of its territory. The Western world will lose about 100% of its political credibility.
Shashank, given what Michael's just said, there is an awful lot at stake for the West and for Europe. In that context, how does the deployment of European and US supplied missiles change the war and the outlook of the war?
Well, it won't have an immediate or a dramatic effect on the front lines, but it will affect the thing that you identified as being the essential characteristic of this war, which is that it's a war of attrition, and it will sap Russian resources. So to take the example of a long-range strike, not by Western missiles, but by Ukraine's own drones and missiles against a site called Toropets maybe a month or two ago, that took out what may have been about 3 months worth of Russian ammunition. Now, of course, that will be replaced, but to lose 3 months worth of ammunition is a serious loss. It reduces the rate of firepower. It reduces, therefore, the rate of casualties inflicted on the Ukrainians. You can eke out their infantry further. So it has all these beneficial effects.
Michael, can we talk about troops? We spoke about Russian losses. Can we talk a bit about the Ukrainian side?
Yeah, it is difficult because the Ukrainian losses are possibly up to 100,000 killed, maybe, and probably 400,000 maybe wounded in action, incapacitated. So Ukrainian losses may be touching 500,000, which is a problem because Ukraine has a population outside the occupied territories of about 33 million, as against Russia with a population of, 140 million. Also, it's not really clear that Ukraine is mobilized to the full extent. I mean, they only mobilize people now over the age of 25. It used to be 27. They brought it down to 25. And that was very controversial, getting that through the Rada, the Ukrainian parliament. We mobilize people at the age of 18. We regard our 18 to 25-year-olds as our prime military stock. But in Ukraine, they take the view that that's the lifeblood of the country and older people, older men should go to fight, and women.
Shashank, can we talk about where this leaves President Zelensky? I mean, Putin doesn't have to suffer from problems of public opinion very much, but President Zelensky has always been a kind of very strong and charismatic figure since the beginning of the war. It's gone on a long time. Is his position as strong as it was?
Absolutely not. You can see his domestic stature. It's been eroding for a while. And if you look at his so-called victory plan, you know, yes, it was about victory and about winning. But underneath that, it's really about saying, look, I'm open to a deal. You've just got to help me create the conditions in which I can do a deal and still keep my country secure and alive. So everyone understands that Ukraine is struggling, but really this is about the quality of the deal that Donald Trump wants to do. That really is the fundamental question that now faces us.
Well, okay. So Shashank, what is the quality of the deal that Donald Trump wants to do?
I don't think he wants a kind of Saigon in Kyiv. I don't think he wants to own a complete collapse of the Ukrainian government. And there are those around him, including Mike Waltz, the nominee for National Security Advisor. He wrote a piece for my colleagues at The Economist a few weeks ago, in which he said, clearly, we know we get leverage to get Vladimir Putin to the table. We have to push the oil price down. Perhaps we have to threaten to give Ukraine more weapons if Putin doesn't come to the table. So there's a sense that he may have to escalate the conflict to be able to de-escalate it. The fundamental problem beyond that, though, is even if you get Putin to the table, is what kind of security guarantees are you willing to give Ukraine? And there are really only a handful of options, which are no guarantees, in which case I think Russia would probably invade again, a sort of fortress Ukraine scenario in which you continue to provide aid to arm them to the teeth. That's very expensive. There's a NATO membership option, and I don't think there's a consensus for that in Europe. And finally, there is the troop option. That is, you put European or American troops inside Ukraine. I think that that's still unlikely, but I have to say, I think it is less unlikely, David, than if you'd asked me that same question a year ago.
Right. I was going to ask, Michael, if America did effectively abandon Ukraine, Europe could make up the deficit. I'm taking it from Shashank's answer that it probably couldn't.
No. I mean, on paper, it ought to be able to, but politically, it's not there yet. And the Europeans certainly couldn't supply the sort of tonnages and numbers of weapons that the United States can supply from its own stocks. But if the United States pull the plug on any more deliveries, then the effect on Ukraine, as Shashank said, wouldn't be absolutely immediate, but it would certainly be cumulative over a period of months into 2025.
One final question. We had the warning recently from Government Minister Pat McFadden about Russian cyber attacks into Britain, Shashank. How seriously should we take that prospect? I've even heard people speculating that the Elizabeth line in London going down in the last day or so may be something to do with the Russians.
Well, the very fact that we're talking about that, I think, is a worrying sign because it shows that Russia can intimidate us without even having to do anything. You know, the fear of completely unrelated things. The truth is, Russia conducts cyber operations against the UK and NATO every week, mostly for espionage, but often for disruption, including against critical infrastructure. But the real problem is not the lights going out across the country. Russia hasn't been able to do that, David, even in Ukraine, a country where it's been, you know, throwing every single cyber tool at its disposal into the fight. The concern really is on a much more limited basis. It's Russia interfering with our democracy. It's Russian disinformation. It's propaganda. Also, sabotage of other kinds. We've had news of Russian intelligence services putting explosives on cargo planes. I think, personally, we have become so fixated on the most extreme scenarios, whether that's nuclear weapons or whether that's sort of Pearl Harbor-like cyber attacks, we've become somewhat distracted from the reality that Russia is conducting a kind of hybrid war against Europe. It's just lower level. It's more pervasive. It doesn't make it any less troubling.
Thank you, Shashank Joshi. My thanks to you, to Michael Clark and Elena Rybakova. And my conclusion, Ukraine seems to need its allies more than ever. And just before we go, on this week's episode of Ukrainecast, Lucy Hockings and Vitaly Shevchenko speak to a former US ambassador to Russia about dealing with Trump, negotiating with Putin, and the prospects for peace. You can download that now on BBC Sounds. As for us, we'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Beth Ashmead-Latham, Kirsty Knight, and Charlotte MacDonald. The sound engineer was James Beard, and the editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
What happens when at-home DNA tests reveal more than you bargained for?
My birth mom was still here. She's still alive.
Six new stories of reconnecting and rupturing families.
I just couldn't believe it. I had a sister, after all.
Lives upended and long-buried secrets.
I then wrote back and said, look, the ripples from this will be enormous. What do you want to do?
The new series of The Gift with me, Jenny Kleeman, from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.